and it's a gamble that they took, and I have a feeling, I can't say for sure, I can't tell what the future will bring, but I have a feeling they're going to lose that gamble. I mean, I'm not naive. Cornell is a corporation, period. I mean, they run this like a business in order to ensure the university's survival in the future. And while I understand that, I mean, one person is probably kind of small beans for them, they have to recognize that they are a corporation that should be making sure that they have a future. And after a while, all of these little insults add up. And so I think even more important than the donors that give, you know, five figures, even more important is their reputation as an R&D institution, as a place of well-respected higher learning. If they don't protect their reputation, they will not attract the best and the brightest. That goes students as well as faculty. And they will slowly see their rankings slide and slide and slide. And so I think even more important than the dollars is what people think of Cornell.
There's a common saying that you can't fight City Hall, but in this case and in other cases, the City of Ithaca seems to be the weaker institution, or at least the poorer one. Same thing, Lauren.
The city has already tried to pull a lot of their levers. When the idea for this absolutely stupid beyond belief parking lot came up, the planning board rejected their proposal.
Well, approving the rest of the West Campus.
Yeah, no, I mean, initiative. I have no problem with the idea of having students and faculty living together to, you know, try to foster a relationship. I don't know if it'll actually work, but, you know, in theory it's nice. I think the city played their card, which was saying no. And unfortunately, in this situation, Cornell decided just to throw as much money and influence at it as possible. And so they sued their way through the courts and elbowed the project through. And unfortunately, the city is in a very delicate position because, as a nonprofit, Cornell doesn't pay any property taxes, even though it's one of the largest landowners, if not the largest, in Tompkins County. And Cornell gives donations in kind in order to support the school system and, you know, the roads and the salaries of the police officers who have to chase down the drunk students, etc. Cornell is, considering the amount of land that they own and how much property tax they should be paying, they pay next to nothing. And so I think the city has to be cognizant of the fact that if Cornell gets too pissed off, the city might lose that little pittance that Cornell does give them.
And there was also, I believe it was last winter, a memorandum of understanding between Ithaca and Cornell that President Lehman or the Cornell administration issued, saying that the money that Cornell gives to the city was contingent upon the city not interfering with the interests of Cornell. And people went to great lengths to say, oh no, this has nothing to do with the parking lot. We just wanted to mention that. It's always been in effect. We're just putting it in writing. But I mean, it's basically a message to Ithaca that, you know, it's almost saying you need us more than we need you.
Fall in step with what we want you to do, because otherwise you're going to be hurting.
Great.
As far as leverage goes, one of the unfortunate places where the city should have had leverage but ended up not having any was that at a certain point Cornell was rezoned, and I don't know the technical terminology associated with it, but at one point there was the idea that or the zoning that saying that for every each building had to have parking capacity proportional to the number of people it could hold. At a certain point, it was rezoned because it was recognized that basically the same people are, you know, living in one area and going to classes in another area and going to the gym in another area. And that's great because it means you need fewer parking spaces overall. And it's worked well. The problem is when the campus was rezoned, there was a buffer provision that didn't make it into the new zoning, saying that within so many feet of the city, there could only be structures or development that were vital to Cornell's educational and research mission. The city doesn't have leverage to say, no, this parking lot is clearly not central to your education and research mission. If there was any gap in the city's actions to keep this parking lot from happening, it was a less than thorough defense by the city attorney when it first came to court. Mm-hmm. And that was during Alan Cohen's administration. And there were some cozy relationships between city administration and Cornell administration.
The previous city administration of Alan Cohen was characterized by many ongoing conflicts between preservation of green space and construction supposed to spur economic development. Route 13 near the Buttermilk Falls Park became a sprawling mass of big box stores and corporate fast food establishments. In the final days of the Cohen administration, a deal was quietly put through that brought Walmart into Ithaca, an eventuality that many community members put years of effort into fighting off. Proponents of retail sprawl claim that these businesses will create jobs and tax revenue and generally benefit the community. In our next segment, we're going to look at that with the author of The Great American Job Scam. But basically, the legal efforts of the city to stop the parking lot in the Redbud Woods expose the nature of the legal system. Might makes right, and money equals might.
But I mean, you also have to realize that Cornell was able to... I looked through the environmental impact statement once, and Cornell was really able to put a lot of time and resources into that. And I mean, the city only has so much manpower and so many resources that I feel like to some extent they were just a little outgunned, you know, because you have a certain amount of time to present your appeal and make your case, and you know, if it's an impossible task, there's just nothing you can do to get around that. So I feel like it wasn't necessarily the city's fault per se, it was just a bad situation.
Right, and Cornell has shown that it's very willing to go to any lengths necessary to push this project
forward.
They are
willing to throw so much money at this, which is part of the reason that I'm so angry. They're wasting the money that my parents paid for me to get an education.
Nevertheless, the defenders of the woods have no intention of giving up.
We're not going to give up hope, we're not going to give up fighting. And in the end, I think that we want and need these woods far more than they think they need the parking lot. And I think that, you know, in the grand scheme of things, pardon me for sounding like an idealist, but in the grand scheme of things, we're doing what's right. And so I think that gives us a lot of, hope and faith and determination. Specifics? Couldn't tell you.
I think there are a few things we're doing at this point. One is visibility. There's no question that this is a black eye for Cornell, and the harder they fight against the position that is right, they are fighting against the position that is in the right. The worse they look, both to the community and as this becomes a bigger story to, you know, the country and the world. I think another thing is trying to reach sympathetic ears within the administration.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not that goes anywhere is anyone's guess.
I hope that somebody, again, just kind of goes somewhere quiet to sit and thinks about what they're doing and why they're doing it. And I hope that somebody, I couldn't say who in the administration, I just hope that somebody realizes that this is not the legacy that I want to leave for my years at Cornell. I would be willing to exert pressure on people who actually make these decisions. For example, on Hunter Rawlings. J. Marie Law was saying earlier that he does have the power. He's got his hand on the button. And so I would have no problem telling him directly that you're a jerk and you're making a wrong decision.
We do need to take this to the top. I would ask people to contact Hunter Rawlings. Mm-hmm. As we've addressed before, even if he's not the true driver behind this, he does have the power to stop this. You can find him in the Cornell directory. Just go to www.cornell.edu, click on People, search for Hunter Rawlings. You can also email president@cornell.edu. He's in the phone book. And also for people in the area, it would mean a tremendous amount just for people to show up for a little bit, spend a few hours at the woods, just be a watchful eye to ensure the safety of the students, faculty, and community members who are in the woods right now. We've talked a lot about the parking lot, but it's about more than just the parking lot. It's about community democracy and sustainability, and really getting those things institutionalized at Cornell and in Cornell's relationship with the city of Ithaca. And that's something that I believe in very passionately, having been first on the Hill and now being down in the bustling town, as it were.
I was and am a student of city planning. And so just from an intellectual point of view, every time I start thinking about it, I just get really angry. And so that drive has really pushed me to be involved. I think another aspect is I didn't grow up in Ithaca, and I didn't have any feelings about the community I grew up in. Typical suburban town, subdivisions and lots of roads and stuff. And it really wasn't until I came to Ithaca that I saw that that's not how it has to be everywhere. And so I see this parking lot as an affront to the way of life that I've chosen.
And judging from the community reaction, Lauren is not alone. To find out more or to get involved, go to www.redbudwoods.org. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, or WZKW Kingsville. It has been pretty much an unquestioned axiom that corporations setting up shop in a community lead to prosperity by bringing jobs. Local politicians have been lured into a bidding war to cut taxes and provide inducements for corporations to relocate. The result has often been deterioration of public infrastructure and the quality of life for the sake of jobs that pay poverty wages. Greg Leroy is the founder of Good Jobs Now, and he is the author of a new book, The Great American Job Scam, Corporate Tax Dodging and the Myth of Job Creation, which is a handbook for communities that strives to debunk the conventional wisdom from the perspective of labor. He spoke last week in Ithaca at the Tompkins County Living Wage Coalition. Greg Leroy.
30 years ago, a very odd thing happened. A company in Pennsylvania called Roxboro Glass sought to relocate business from Pennsylvania to North Carolina, about 300 jobs. And obviously, most of the time that happened in the 70s and 60s and 70s and 80s, it was a matter of union busting. Companies were running away from unions in the Northeast and the Midwest to the South, the Sun Belt. In this case, they actually sort of let it be known that they wouldn't resist a union if the union followed them, and that they were going to pay pretty good wages. And when the city fathers of Roxboro, North Carolina, found that out, they said, "You're not coming. We're revoking the deal we offered you." The word got out, though, that they had done this, which was unusual. Most aborted deals never get disclosed. And the people in Roxboro went nuts, and the city fathers all had to resign from the planning board because they wanted the good jobs, and they were not pleased to hear that the company wasn't going to come. A company called Fantas, which is kind of the granddaddy of site location consulting firms based then in New York and later in Chicago, was moved to comment at the time that this was actually quite common. They said literally scores of companies have been turned away from southern towns because of their wage rates or union policies. After all, if Brockway came in with a union and high wages, who would want to come to Roxboro? Said the president of the biggest site location consulting firm, Fantas Company. Another official in Gastonia told the Wall Street Journal at the same time, he says, if you tell them you have a union, boom, they'll flat run you out of town on the next plane. So the idea that the South pirated jobs from the North with subsidies is partly true. Many of the subsidies that became more common all over the country were born in the South, even dating back to the 30s. But there's a whole other agenda here about wage suppression and union busting as part of the wage suppression agenda that's overlaid with the idea of companies moving jobs around and taxpayers paying companies to move jobs around, even union busting agendas within regions of New York State, I've been told and people know about. The whole issue has become much bigger than just company-specific runaway shops, though. The issue has really become about entire state corporate income tax codes and entire ways in which states tax companies, both for their property and sales and income taxes. Another example I wail away on in the book is the case of Raytheon, which in 1995 basically let it be known to the state of Massachusetts that they were going to pull out in a big way if they didn't get a massive rewrite of the corporate income tax code in a way that benefited them massively, that taxed much less of their income in the state of Massachusetts. By the time all the dust had settled in that process that played out over the next 2 years, every defense contractor, every manufacturer, and every mutual fund company, because Fidelity jumped on the gravy train shortly after, got a massive rewrite of the state income tax code in a way called single sales factor, so that a tiny portion of their income would now be taxed in Massachusetts, even though the bulk of their employment and property and business activity occurred in the Bay State. By the time it was over, a decade later, those two cuts for those two industries, manufacturing and mutual funds, had cost the state treasury $1.5 billion, and Massachusetts was leading the country in the rate at which state aid to education was being slashed as a result of the impoverishment of its tax base. If you look up the records of companies that have gotten economic development subsidies, right? The average state does it 30 different ways now. Property tax abatements, corporate income tax credits, sales tax exemptions, cheap, low-interest tax-free loans, land write-downs, infrastructure improvement, brownfield assistance, et cetera, et cetera. If you look up the records of companies that have gotten those deals, as many state auditors and investigative journalists and nonprofits and tax watchdogs have been doing for the last 20 years, you will invariably find many discrepancies. It's just inevitable. You'll find lots of companies that have failed to create as many jobs as they promised, many companies that have actually laid people off even after getting subsidies, companies that are paying poverty wages, companies that are failing to provide health care, companies that are running onto farmland and running away from pockets of poverty in urban areas. Fill in the blank about what you might dislike about corporate behavior, and chances are the companies that you're looking at have been the beneficiaries of these subsidies because they're so ubiquitous, right? They're so easy to get for anybody who wants to go get them. They're there for the asking, essentially. So we're living in a nation brimming with scandals tied to these scams. The obvious question is, how do companies get away with it? How could it be that there's been so many discrepancies and so many reports that have come out documenting the fact that taxpayers are getting ripped off by many companies that get these subsidies? It's a complicated story that's played out over a number of decades. It's a system, a very deliberately constructed system that I call the Great American Job Scam, which enables companies to use the sheep's clothing or the mantra jobs, 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 get big tax breaks and other subsidies from taxpayers, and then fail to deliver. That's the nub story that has to be understood. There's a lot of moving parts and a lot of players to the system, but understanding it is not rocket science. It's really all there. By the 1970s, it had emerged pretty full-blown. By then, we had Fantas and other site location consulting companies that were specializing in playing states and cities against each other, right? Representing companies secretly, not identifying their clients, whipsawing places against each other to see who will up the ante, even if the company's already made up its mind ahead of time about where it really wants to go. playing off places against each other to up the ante. Often, the site location consultant is getting paid on commission, getting a fraction of the subsidies that it negotiates for companies in that transaction, so it has a direct financial interest in running up the bill associated with such episodes. We have business climatologists, right? Grant Thornton. Anybody remember the old Grant Thornton studies that used to come out of Chicago every year? Invariably found North Dakota had the best business climate in the country, even though there's, like, nothing really going on much in North Dakota. but it always had the best business climate. And, of course, all the other states that were supposedly the best business climates were the South, with right to work and very little going on, very low income rates and very high poverty rates, but great, you know, super low business tax and lots of policies to help companies suppress wages.
So why didn't they go to North Dakota?
Because there's not much to link to there. There's not a very skilled labor force. There's not many other materials or other companies there to relate to. There's a tiny number of people, so the markets, if you're trying to be close to your customers, that's not where you're going to find them. I mean, people don't go to North Dakota for business basic reasons. And also by the 1970s was created a thing called the Council on State Taxation, which emerged really as a full-blown corporate network to orchestrate attacks on states and state systems attempting to cooperate with an overt adversarial relationship with something called the Multi-State Tax Commission, which was a body created in the 60s by the states to try to harmonize their tax codes and cooperate in ways that would create a uniform system for taxing all corporate income somewhere, so that there would not be so-called nowhere income, where states, by creative accounting, could have profits that would never be taxed in any state. Today, we have a much more full-blown cast of characters. Now we have actually a body of consultants, because subsidies are so common and so irrelevant to corporate decision-making and so overgrown and overblown, there's some consultants, like a company called Mintax, that do nothing but help companies make sure they don't leave money on the table. On a for a commission, they'll go out and scour the trough to make sure you didn't miss anything that you qualified for. Even retroactively, they'll go back and get money for you after the fact and take a cut and make sure you get your tax credits or whatever it is you're entitled to. We have rented economists who are ready to do rosy projections about what giant, you know, cuts or giveaways will do for your magic state economy if you just rewrite your tax code or cook up a subsidy. And even in four states now have legalized the buying and selling of economic development tax credits. That is, they're so overblown and companies have so little use for them, they now want to trade them and market them to each other. That's how overgrown the system has become.
I'm sorry, I don't understand why they're irrelevant, the subsidies, because they sure seem to use them. I mean, this is how Sam Walton got rich, right? By nickel and diming everyone.
Well, that's one of the ways he got rich. Sure, let's do site location 101 a minute. When a company's looking for a place to move or relocate or expand, they, if it's a big company, they'll hire a site location consultant. About two-thirds of big deals involve site location consultants. And they'll say to the site location consultant, we make widgets, and to make widgets, we need XYZ things. You know, if it's a high-tech widget, we need to be close to an R&D lab. If it's a polluting widget, we need to be close to a body of water. if it's a fresh-caught widget that needs access to a freight airport, you know, we need to be next to a big freight hub. If we need a lot of particular software code writers for our widget, we need to be close to a labor market that's got a lot of people that already know how to write that kind of software code. Most companies have, you know, a short list of particular things that matter a lot to them and that they can't live without. Cheap electricity for people making titanium or aluminum or things like that. And so they tell the site location consultant, go get us a list of places that meet those criteria, that have those special ingredients that are the big cost items for us, for our business. Oh, and by the way, we also want to be close as we can be to our customers or ways to get to our customers, and we also need to be close to our suppliers because we don't want to pay a lot for transportation, getting our materials and our inputs. The site location consultant goes out and develops a list. Sometimes they say it's a very long list, 15 or 20 places. I think it's usually more like 5 or 7 places. And the company will scratch a few off for subjective reasons. The golf courses aren't good enough, or it's too close to a competitor, or the schools aren't good enough for the boss's kids, or whatever the issues are. And now we're down
to... Those are important, though.
Yeah.
They really are.
For some companies, school quality, I don't want to be flippant about that. If the company is seeking to attract a lot of skilled people that don't already live in the area, the quality of schools will matter a great deal, and the company will pay a lot of attention to that, and I explain that issue a lot in the book. I'm being flippant about the suburban school district, the upscale suburban school district where the executive might expect to, you know, put his kids. So now we're down to a list of 5 or 7 locations, or even 3 to 5 now that the few have been scratched off for subjective reasons. And the company says, okay, go kick the tires. Only at that point does the consultant then physically visit the locations and knock on the door of the local economic development agencies and say, I have a client. I can't name the client, but they need X number of square feet. They're going to create X number of jobs. They're going to invest X number of dollars. What have you got for us? Well, look what just happened right there. The perception of the public official got incredibly distorted, because all they know is somebody knocked on their door and said, I might have some jobs, but let's first talk about subsidies.
Yeah.
What's being forgotten is that the only reason the conversation is happening is because that community is an inherently profitable location for the company. The consultant would never waste his time standing there if that were not true. Any subsidies that are offered are icing on the cake, but the cake is baked. And chances are, in many cases, the company's actually already decided where it wants to go. It's going through this exercises with cities B, C, and D to play off city A for maximum subsidies.
So then they're not irrelevant, because that's all the local industrial development agency has is the subsidies. And they might be losing this client, so they try to come up with something better.
I disagree.
And
they are, except for a tiny fraction of cases, estimated at 2 to 3% of the cases where there's really a true tie, subsidies are irrelevant. That's the only time they can be relevant, is when there's a true tie. And statistically, the evidence says that's 2 to 3% of the time. The other 97 or 98% of the time, you're wasting money. You're spending money in a way that, for something that would have occurred otherwise.
So the local IDA could just say, I got a skilled labor force for you, and that's
it. Great transportation
infrastructure. And we've got all the, and come back with all the things that you said they're looking for, instead of the subsidies. They can say that, no subsidies, but we've got, you know, we're close to your clients, and we're close, so they just come right back at them with it. Beautiful.
And well, you stress your business basics. I mean, rushing ahead to the punchline of the last chapter, you know, I think the money would be much better spent on things that benefit all employers. And at the top of that list are skills and infrastructure. And look, as taxpayers, I like thinking about spending money on things that can't run away right now. If we're going to live in an area of hypermobile capital, I would much rather spend money on workers and their skills, who are going to walk across the street and take their skills to another employer if their current employer decides to leave or fails. And I'd rather spend money on infrastructure that benefits all employers, again, no matter which individual employer runs away or fails. As in terms of not putting a lot of eggs in one basket, but investing in things that are going to stay put and keep paying off for me as a taxpayer, I like skills and infrastructure.
Okay.
And frankly, because of the aging baby boom generation about to retire, how many people in this room were born between 1946 and 1964? I'm guessing a lot of hands are going to go up. Yeah. We baby boomers are beginning to check out en masse in 3 more years. That's when the first wave hits. We need a lot more skilled labor in this country. We're about to lose a boatload of it. So...
Can I
use
this
analogy?
Yeah,
why don't I finish my introductory remarks?
I'm sorry.
Thanks.
Katie, sorry.
You know, it'd be easy to overlook all the chicanery, all these consultants, all this selling and buying of credits if all boats are rising, but I think we all know that's not true. That's why there is a living wage coalition, frankly, right? We know that the average wages for most working families have stagnated for the last quarter century. We know fewer people have pensions. We know fewer people have health care, and they're paying more for what they have. We know that many cities and states have developed structural deficits and recurring budget crises that occur every time the economy gets soft. So the system isn't paying off. I mean, if the system was paying off and we all had great jobs and better health care and better pensions and our public systems were flush to provide the services we need, it would be easy maybe to overlook all this. But none of that's true anymore. It's absolutely not true in most places in this country. The problem, the core ideological problem, I think, that this all gets down to is a corporate corrupted definition of competition. It's a gospel that says public officials may never cooperate in our self-interest. mayors within a metro area can't cooperate, governors within a region can't cooperate. They must be kept in the dark. They must be allowed into the room only when it's time to talk about subsidies. Mm-hmm. They cannot cooperate in our self-interest. That's the problem. You know, governors say, well, we've got to create no-tax zones for manufacturers because we have to compete with other states. Dr. Peter Fisher at the University of Iowa has documented in many states now for new investment, for new capital investment, manufacturing companies are getting negative corporate income tax rates. They're generating net loss carry-forwards against taxable income in future years because the value of the credits exceeds what they would be expected to pay for corporate income taxes. Mayors say, oh, we've got to have a new TIF district for a mega mall or a big box power center, right? Even though there's already dead malls and dead commercial strips in the same metro area, we're going to pirate retail sales and move it around, and we're going to subsidize it with tax increment financing or other giveaways, even though you're just moving buying power around. You're not creating new wealth. When those things happen, the public officials are buying into these corrupted definitions of competition. That's what's really going on. The peddlers of these definitions really are thumbing their nose at common sense and social science and good government, orchestrating a campaign to divide and conquer the states and the suburbs from each other. And if you look at the history, which I try to lay out very quickly in the book, companies have gone to very great lengths for 50 years to try to enforce this gospel of competition rather than cooperation among public officials. If you look at the history of something called the Multi-State Tax Commission especially, you know, litigation all the way up to the Supreme Court, lobbying aggressively at the state and local level, consulting studies, public relations, it's still going on. There's a war right now on Capitol Hill about proposed legislation being sponsored by two big corporate coalitions that is just the latest iteration of this war to perpetuate dog-eat-dog, you know, devil-take-the-hindmost lack of cooperation among public officials. That's what's at the core of this problem. There's lots of other collateral damage I lay out in the book. If you care about other issues, whatever they are, I document the fact that subsidies to foreign auto transplants was used to blunt trade reform talk long before NAFTA was known to us. It gets used to pay for private for-profit prisons. It subsidizes hundreds of Walmart facilities. We've documented more than $1 billion worth of that. It subsidizes lots of poverty wage employers besides Walmart that saddle us with hidden taxpayer costs in the form of Medicaid and CHIP and Section 8 housing assistance and free school lunches and other things like that. It's absolutely a major driver in a long-term burden shift of tax burden shift being shifted away from large companies and on to everybody else, on to working families and on to small businesses. And I document, there's now studies in about half the states documenting how little major companies are paying toward their corporate income tax bills in states. And a mountain of evidence showing that in terms of the income tax rate they pay and the share of revenues they contribute to state coffers, state income taxes are falling off a cliff. Please.
Well, for the last 20 or 30 years, when you're talking about tax, well, false pricing and all these other regulations and taxes, you must talk in your book about the internationalization of this bidding war as a race to the bottom. What do you say about that?
I don't go into much detail about globalization. I mean, I make the point that globalization is obviously the huge issue, especially in manufacturing right now, and that it dwarfs anything a state or city could do. And therefore, for states or cities to think that they're actually fighting globalization by doing some massive giveaway, like rewriting their corporate income tax code the way Massachusetts did, is a folly, frankly.
So is there a leveling of the playing field that you espouse for a local action to take on this giveaway?
Well, yeah, I talk a lot about what we call smart growth policies at the regional level. That is, let's not subsidize retail at all anymore, except if you're talking about a truly distressed inner-city neighborhood that lacks basic, you know, grocery, drug, clothing stores. Let's make sure that nothing about the way we tax activity at the local level creates dumb land use policy. That is, let's get rid of all point-of-sale sales tax collection because you're just giving an incentive for one jurisdiction to pirate sales from another and therefore grossly overbuild retail, which is terrible land use policy. So revenues generally at the regional level should be shared so that you're not, in the name of jobs, you're not overbuilding economic activity. We'll also talk about the fact that not one state in this country deliberately links jobs to public transportation. Of all the 1,500 different economic development subsidy programs on the books in the 50 states, not one even gives preference to, much less requires that, the jobs getting subsidized are accessible by bus or train. I think that's nuts. I think by coordinating land use policy, especially transportation policy, with jobs, you could make much more efficient use of both your subsidies and your land. So those are examples of how we talk about leveling regional playing fields.
And you probably didn't have a chance to comment on the eminent domain decision of the Supreme Court, which mystifies me to this day how you have the more liberal part of the court endorsing that against the states' rights, so-called states' rights. Yes.
Right. I assume people are familiar here with the New Britain case that came down last week, the Supreme Court decision. Yeah, we have not worked much on that issue. We're not a legal shop. It raises all kinds of very thorny issues about what is economic development and what is public good, frankly. I think that the phrase public good got really horribly abused in that case, because I don't think of what's going on there as a public good, really. And as difficult as that case is, and as problematic, I mean, I was just in Syracuse now, and there's 29 businesses have organized themselves against the proposed use of eminent domain for part of the Destiny Project up there. Go to the neighborhood, they've all got signs up, ban abuse of eminent domain. They're totally educated and mobilized about it. And I wish them well, and as problematic as the decision is, you hope that public officials are chastened, because there'll be a backlash. If that decision triggers a much more freewheeling use of eminent domain for cases like New Britain, it's inevitable there'll be a backlash. The Senate Finance Committee has already slated a hearing for a proposed federal bill that would basically rip federal money out of a deal like that. That's the Fed's reaction already. At the same turns, a few months ago, the same committee heard a bill, which they would love to enact, I suspect, that would basically green light this whole process and overturn a case called Cuno, now headed to the Supreme Court, that would declare a lot of this stuff unconstitutional under the Commerce Clause. So it's very, very conflicted, very tricky in that respect. The point I like to make is that whatever the fate of eminent domain in this stuff, what we're talking about tonight, bread and butter, revenue bonds, tax abatements, corporate income tax credits, empire zones, IDAs, is so much more pervasive and so much more corrupt and problematic, because most of it happens under the radar screen. The average hearing isn't attended by citizens. The average deal isn't contested. The average thing is not the subject of a legal dispute and an appeal to a higher court. This stuff just happens every day, and it's just eating our lunch.
People don't even know it's happening.
Yeah, it's just invisible. I mean, thanks to the Living Wage Coalition, thanks to the Fiscal Policy Institute, thanks to various coalitions that have cropped up around some of the IDAs in upstate New York, I think of Monroe County as well, with the group up there, people are asking questions, and people are going to the hearings, and people are contesting the Cintas deal and other things around around the state. And that's exactly as it should be. And once you go through that process and learn the alphabet soup and learn the programs, there's no going back, I think.
You mentioned people. Monroe County. There's a note to you from Chris Kale, who was a graduate student in city planning and did a bunch of research for Greg's operation in New York on Monroe County. And one of the things she discovered in these really obscure statistical tables published by the state of New York, they were almost impossible to read. It was just misery doing this research, was that a huge amount of the subsidies offered by the Monroe County IDA, Mike, you might know this in detail, I don't know, went to Wegmans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is that, you just said, it's a totally inappropriate locational subsidy. You put food stores where people want to buy food. They're going to put them there anyway if people want to buy the foods. The subsidies are... Now, it may have been a good strategy for boosting Rochester vis-a-vis someplace else, but it's nonsense. Well,
to that point, our community, our IDA, was the first and I think still the only IDA in New York State to deny Wegmans' request for local property tax abatement.
To some extent, you're preaching to the
to the choir in this particular county. But
let's, and let's just underscore what happened here. You know, in my opinion, retailing is not economic development. It's not about raising living standards. Retailing is what happens if people have disposable income. And if Wegmans does the research on the zip code and likes the disposable income levels of those households, they're going to capture, they're going to go for the market share. And it's generally, it's the same problem you encounter with public officials negotiating for a Walmart. They don't understand that sitting across the table from Walmart, the trophy on the table is not the Walmart. The trophy on the table is Walmart getting more market share. And until they understand what's really being negotiated there, it's hard to not give away the store.
Isn't this the corollary of supply-side economics as opposed to Keynesian? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of trickle-down.
Or I guess as Mr. Bush called it, voodoo economics. I think he had it right. In that.
Please.
To what extent are politicians being bribed in one way or another to go along with this stupidity?
You know, I would like to do a study, and I've tried to figure out how to do a study looking at the relationship between companies that get the biggest subsidies and campaign contributions. The trouble is that at, campaign finance disclosure exists almost exclusively at the state level, but it's mostly local officials that are the most murkily involved in, you know, allegations of brother-in-laws cashing in on land deals and stuff like that. So you have this data problem where you've got state data but local shenanigans, and I don't know how to reconcile those to try to mesh the two together. Anecdotally, you know, you hear of cases of people going to work for companies later, relatives, you know, cashing in on land deals. Obviously, the secrecy surrounding the early stages of a deal is an invitation for abuse by people who are inside the secret, you know, the Chamber of Commerce or the EDC or whoever's, you know, driving the recruitment process. But there's very little stuff out there because it's very hard to get the data together.
Yeah, maybe a way to look at that rather than contributions, since so many of the politicians are in the same pool, really. They're all in favor of it, but those that are against it, what contributions are there being laid out to defeat candidates that speak up? Mm. That might be easier to trace.
Yeah, that's true. And I, you know, the I make the point in the book that a public official who would dare to ask an impertinent question like, is this a good deal, or does do the benefits, you know, actually, you know, match up to the costs, or should we be given retail subsidies? The average reaction, especially from the pro-corporate lobbyists to somebody like that, is to ridicule them, is to single them out and say, you're against jobs. Right? Yeah. And that's death politically. And a lot of politicians know that might happen to them and shy away from asking impertinent questions for that reason. I think that's why it's an important thing for all of us to not only have a full-bodied analysis about sort of how the world goes around and how these, what's really driving these deals, but also to have positive counter-suggestions. And that's how I want to really finish my talk. I lay out in the last chapter a raft of positive reforms that are being enacted on the ground, like living wages, that cover not just procurement, but also companies that get economic development subsidies. It's very common now. 43 states, 45 cities, 5 counties do it for at least one of their subsidy programs. You know, wages, healthcare, full-time hours. Clawbacks, money-back guarantee language. What a radical idea. Company falls 50% short, taxpayers get 50% of their money back. You know, give them 3 or 4 years or whatever to get to their goals, and then if they don't make it, we get made whole for the shortfall. Disclosure. 12 states now have some form of annual company-specific disclosure of costs and benefits. 4 states put it on the web. Illinois is coming online with the web right now. Come on, it's 2005. The technology is there. The data is all there. Why can't we see it? Why can't we see it? You know, a lot of places have property tax records online. I live in a highly automated, high-tech county. Somebody from China can look at my property tax records, but I can't find out how much Marriott Corporation is dodging on its income taxes for its big, you know, sweetheart deal that it got in my county a few years ago. I don't think that's right. Please.
Related to that, I've been wondering, since it is often a hush-hush sort of deal, what problems you run into doing research for this sort of thing, and how did you get the information you needed to see trends?
the footnotes are a mishmash of things we've been collecting for, you know, so I've been collecting since the late 70s, essentially. In those states where there is disclosure, we have really just chowed down. You know, I've done three studies in Minnesota since they passed disclosure in 1995, as an example. I've sort of played it out as hard as I can. Maine, Connecticut have disclosure laws, and groups up there have done great studies. Illinois, we're going to do a study. We're starting cranking up to do a study because the first wave of disclosure is just coming online right now. Investigative journalists. I mean, the other point is, absent disclosure, you can sketch this story as I laid it out and find lots of discrepancies. It's just much more labor-intensive. So you've got to file a Freedom of Information Act, get the list of companies, set up your own spreadsheet, track what they did, call them up and find out how many jobs they have, look at manufacturing directories and business directories to see what they've been reporting their jobs to be over time. And it can be done. It's just very labor-intensive. It's the kind of thing that graduate students and investigative reporters spend hours working on.
It seems to me like it would be relatively easy, really. You know, you just take the Michael Moore approach and sort of interview the public officials and then find out what kind of subsidies the company got later, and then go back and look at the local legislator's voting record. And if it doesn't match up, you know they lied, and then go back and interview them again and say, well, what happened here? You said you weren't going to give them these subsidies, and you know, but you did. And get them on camera. Show the public.
Michael Moore actually did a couple of segments where he used this issue, and they were hilarious. Yeah. And he basically made the point in the episodes he featured that no new jobs were getting created at all. Companies were simply moving around, one especially in a union-busting gesture. But it was all the same jobs.
I wonder, too, if you could comment on a couple of the things we hear a lot about in planning. Well, not so much in the planning literature, but in the popular realm, about the creative class and what cities they're drawn to, and if that, how that relates to what you're talking about, if it does. And also the whole Michael Porter thing with, you know, Center for Urban Competitiveness or whatever thing, because he's so popular, a lot of people know about him and just love the guy.
Yeah.
And how do you even begin to counter that kind of stuff?
I claim no particular expertise in Richard Florida or Michael Porter. I've never met either of them. I've heard Florida speak once. I've read some of the stuff. I've read a little bit of Porter stuff over the years, but not very much. I will say this. The idea that the availability of skilled labor matters, which Florida sort of put on steroids and fancified, is correct. If you look at the site location literature right now, the availability of skilled labor is the number one determinant about where companies are expand or locate. And I believe that's only going to be even more true for the rest of our working lives, especially because of the baby boom retirement thing coming up. It matters for good jobs. It matters for recruiting highly skilled people because they care about the quality of the school system, which, you know, correlates highly to the presence of highly skilled individuals. I just think it's objectively true. I spend an entire chapter 5 making the point that therefore there's a huge collision between two very common subsidies, property tax abatements and tax increment financing, and a good business climate, because companies don't want to pay property taxes. Now, you and I should be so lucky to move into our preferred school district where we decide the test scores are best for our kids and get a 10-year break on our property taxes. Companies get to do that all the time. What's the matter with this picture? You know, and therefore they're not paying their share of the freight for the schools, undermining them, harming the business climate. In my opinion, it's really counterintuitive, but I believe that's what's going on. And the same with TIF, because it's a diversion, and the money doesn't go to schools when it gets diverted into the TIF district.
So why would transnational corporations be interested in having anything other than what currently exists in terms of labor markets overseas played off against an unequal playing field here in terms of environmental law, regulatory agency costs, other costs that go into their collateral costs as compared to China and India?
Yeah, they're in the catbird seat. I totally agree. I mean, I think a lot of, especially in the area of manufacturing and potentially as outsourcing affects more parts of the service sector, trade policy is trumping what anything can be done by state or local officials. And I think state and local officials have to get honest about that and quit flailing around, pissing away a lot of money ineffectively for that reason.
Aren't they part of the game plan, though? I mean, I see the American Enterprise institute going to state legislatures and introducing legislation that has no democratic backing within the individual states, but is totally driven by the Fortune 500 corporations. So how do people in community take on that kind of power when they're not even aware that those laws are being introduced on behalf of the Fortune 500 corps? And I, from having dealt with these agencies all my life, know how easy it is to be co-opted by political appointees at a much higher level. You can win the battle all the way up to the commissioner of a regulatory agency and then have that commissioner make the decision. So it seems to me the solution here has to be education of, as your book, of course, is an example.
No, look, let's be honest. The orchestrated corporate assault I talk about on state tax systems is not an isolated event. There's an orchestrated assault on torts and environmental regulation and labor regulation and lots of other fronts. These are not isolated events, right? And the traditional business climate ratings reflected that agenda, which had not much to do with taxes. I mean, taxes were part of it, but there's a lot of other stuff that they always rated the states on. Those are all the things you're referring to. And I agree with you. I think education is key to it. One of the reasons why I believe it's worth working on this part of that multifaceted problem is because it's so tangible to people. You can really attach dollar figures to specific companies and specific failed outcomes. It's an easy way to get a grip on it and get your teeth into it because there's real horror stories, there's real blood on the floor. And I think the transformative process of getting people involved in fight back campaigns and fixing these things opens their eyes to a lot of other problems. That's my MO. That's my theory. Why I'm doing what I'm doing. That's what gets me out of bed in the morning. But I totally agree with your analysis. Yeah. This is not an isolated thing.
Newspapers often trumpet. I mean, they seem to be great allies. You know, about these empire zones and everything. Are they just swallowing hook, line, and sinker, the corporate line, or are they?
On our website is a study called Straying from Good Intentions, where we documented how many states, including New York, have perverted two kinds of programs that were originally intended to help depressed areas. Enterprise zones, or aka empire zones here in New York State, or tax increment financing, TIF districts. New York State, more than any other state, has perverted its empire zone program. By four different measures we used in that study, the state has loosened the rules to make them so meaningless as to become incredibly ineffective and wasteful. And we just lay that out in gross detail about allowing them to be much bigger, allowing them to migrate, allowing them to mutate non-contiguously so you can have floating blobs of zones out there that are not even connected to the original pocket of poverty. This is the worst imaginable public policy to people that really care about poverty. I just point out many, many episodes of companies getting subsidies, doing nothing for poverty, and arguing that it is a valid purpose to address poverty, but you can only do that if you really write the rules in ways that make sure the money goes where it's intended and gets to the people to whom it's intended to benefit. One of the best examples is, when I'm talking about the lack of integration of public transportation to jobs. There's a very obvious racial element to a decision like that. Car ownership in this country is not equally distributed, obviously not by income and very much not by race. African-American households are about 3.5 times more likely not to own a car than white households. Hispanic households more than twice as likely not to own a car. If you're designing a job subsidy system which is indifferent to whether people that need to ride a bus can get to the jobs, you're saying you don't care if they have opportunity about getting to work. If we were to deliberately require companies to put jobs on the transit grid, at least in metro areas that have systems where that's a realistic requirement, it would have great poverty reduction implications because it would mean a lot more people would have access to new opportunities.
Well, that spins other stuff off too, Greg. For example, you have zones where there's just where industrial development works for people. That limits sprawl. Sprawl creates an enormous waste of public resources. You have to build roads, you have to put in pipe, you have to put in electrical wire. Stuff costs money.
Yeah.
and the people have less money, and there's less tax being generated, so that the services that are needed to do that and to upkeep those are actually being undermined by the very sprawl.
Yes.
So it's got this sort of double edge to it.
That's right.
So a reasonable program that tries to target areas of a community,
yeah,
for industrial, light industrial, heavy industrial, or manufacturing development makes perfect sense. And actually, for employers to move in there, if it's done correctly, will cut their costs as well.
Absolutely.
But it's impossible in the climate where everything is seen as jobs become... There's a panacea. The word jobs becomes a panacea to everything. And every decision is made on... And I don't think politicians are taking... Most of them are taking money. I think it's just... That's sort of a hobgoblin we put in our own heads to justify the fact that the whole bloody society is out of whack on these questions. It's actually not even their fault. They can't see it any more than a lot of ordinary people can see it. And they get elected, and people say to them, "I need a job in my community. I don't want it in Cortland. I want it in Ithaca." It doesn't matter that in real terms, in wealth generating terms, if it's in Cortland or it's in Ithaca, it's probably the same thing. As long as it's a decent job. I just think that these things, they sort of build on themselves. So you cut against that, you educate folks, and then you take up specific programs to help push those things. And we got a shot at turning this around.
Yes, Steve. It seems that the ability of corporations to play everybody off against everybody else, to socialize the costs and privatize the benefits, is endless in the absence of a national movement, a coordinated, essentially political movement, with a clear ideology and it clearly states what's going on in terms of people understand and can mobilize around it. I mean, in the absence of something on that scale, it seems like it's virtually unstoppable, because you can even, I mean, these are good issues on a local level around which to organize, but there's always that jurisdiction next door which stands in opposition. And that's a pretty tall order. But really, the hope in that, it seems to me, and I'll just get your reaction to stop in a second, is that this stuff is in people's face to such an extent, it's so clear, corporations are so vulnerable in their policies, the damage wrought by the destruction of the public sector for just this purpose and the ability of corporations to control in this way is so great that the potential for a political movement is enormous.
Well, I hope you're right. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I didn't think there was enormous potential here.
That was Greg LeRoy, author of The Great American Job Scam, Corporate Tax Dodging, and the Myth of Job Creation, speaking last week in Ithaca, New York. To contact us or download archived MP3s of this and other episodes of Unwelcome Guests, visit our website at unwelcomeguests.org. We'll resume our ongoing class series with economic historian Doug Dowd next week. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by